The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. So we did have a fabulous time in Philadelphia last weekend. Brian and I spent an entire day before the Philly Bike Expo exploring historic places of interest in the city of brotherly love. Now, I was born there. I've been back a few times, but I never spent a whole day just going through some of the wonderful places. Like we saw the Liberty Bell, which I had never actually seen up close. It's a big bell with a big crack in it, but you know what? It evokes some emotional stuff when you see this. It was awe-inspiring, especially right now. You know, we look back at our country's often contentious history and see some of the trials and tribulations we went through to become the independent and successful nation we are today. We actually went with a National Park Service tour, and those people are always so well-informed and deliver the information in such a compelling way. I like doing that stuff, and I'm not the sightseeing type, I guess. Maybe I am now. I also want to thank everyone who stopped by our table at the Philly Bike Expo to say hello last weekend. Some of you introduced yourselves. You said nice things about the show, which is always heartwarming to me. I actually had someone ask if he could take my picture to send to his brother-in-law, and I have to say, I was pretty flattered. That was pretty cute. So, brother-in-law, if you're listening to the show and you know who you are, I hope you like the picture, and thank you for listening. We really had a great time. In addition to catching up with so many of our friends like Don Walker, Richard Sachs, Stephen Belenke, and Rody Walter, we had more than 30 people sit in on our touring talk, which is really nice because there were a lot of other talks going on at the same time, and people took time off of the exhibit floor to come down to the seminar room and ask some really cool questions. We got to sort of show off our expertise a little bit. The expo has grown enormously since we first attended it 5 years ago. I believe it's a force to reckon with for other bike shows all up and down the East Coast. So a big hats off to Bina Belenke Trahan for all her hard work in making it such a big success. It was all over the city. People knew that this expo was happening. So let's move on to this week's show. My first guest is just delightful. She's an artist by the name of Talia Lempert. And I actually saw her. I have seen her before at the show, and I guess I never put it all together. But I went up to her booth, and I looked at the stuff, and I'm like, I know who you are. You've probably seen her paintings, too. Her work has been featured on many magazine covers, in books, galleries, shops. And she's made the bicycle the focus of her work, continues to produce new and interesting pieces all the time. She works mainly in oil, which I did not know. She offers a custom painting of your bike, much the way we might commission a portrait of our kids, our husband, wife, or our pets, you know, dog portraits. Those are always cool. She loves all bicycles. She sees them from a perspective you and I may not consider. And I think my conversation with her is going to make you smile. It's just delightful. We'll break for some current news, and then we're going to head on down to the Carolinas and catch up with journalist Dan Worry to wrap up the 2016 season. He always has such a great perspective on riders and teams and stages of races, so I always like talking with him. So let's head on off to Brooklyn, New York, and chat with artist and cyclist Talia Lempert. Talia, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Diane. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you know, it was fun to actually see you in person in Philly last weekend. That was kind of cool, just kind of walking up to your booth and go, there she is. That was really good. How was the show for you?
The show was really fun. It was great, you know, to see everything there and then to meet people.
That wasn't your first bike show, was it?
Oh, no.
No, I didn't think so.
No, it's a Philly. It was actually like the third time I've done the Philly bike show. I did it a couple times at the beginning when they were in the armory. And then I did it last year.
How did I possibly miss you?
I don't know. I feel like we've met before.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, this is the fourth time I've done the Philly show. Anyway, let's talk about your art and your bicycles. I think most of our listeners, because they get magazines and because they're on social media, have seen your bicycle paintings, and they really are beautiful. They're unique, actually. Tell us a little bit about your background, your history.
I was raised in Ithaca, New York. It's a beautiful area, and my father loved cycling, so it was a big part of family life. We used to go riding together, first in a trailer, and then on a tandem, and then on our own bikes. And then I got interested in painting when I was in high school, and then I studied it in college. I went to the Boston Museum School, and then I moved to New York to go to the New York Academy of Art. And I left a bike at home when I went to college, and I didn't ride at all for about 10 years.
So how did artist meet bicycle? You moved to Brooklyn, obviously, because that's where you
are. I moved to Brooklyn. Yeah, and I'd been in New York for a while, and I'd been serious about painting for years. I was working as a decorative painter. In my studio, I was doing my own artwork. I painted mostly pictures of people and that kind of hinted at a story. And I wasn't thinking about cycling at all. And then one day, I was walking down the street, and I saw a bike in front of a bike shop. It was a little white folding bike, one of those like Italian vintage ones, and it was $80, so I just bought it, and I started riding it everywhere, and it totally changed the way I experienced the city. Instead of knowing like a radius around a subway stop, I was just really was learning how the whole city fit together, and it was so exciting riding places and getting places on my own energy. And then the bike was so beautiful and the whole thing was so inspiring that I started to paint it. And then I started meeting more cyclists and borrowing their bikes. And then I got a track bike and I thought I may as well start racing it. So I got really into racing for probably about 7 years, and the whole time painting the bikes. And it was kind of painting my community, recording my community. Did that make sense?
Yeah, of course it makes sense. So how would you describe your art? I look at the style of your bikes, and it sort of has a feel of some realism and not altogether. So what would you call the style that you paint in?
You know, I don't know. I'm painting from observation, so representational painting.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a good description.
I usually paint the bike on a flat ground, you know, usually on a color or sometimes with stripes, and sometimes I let it get a little more active. I like to paint until I can feel it, and sometimes that happens really quickly with just a few strokes, and sometimes I work on them for a really long time.
Yeah.
So that I could feel like I could grab the bars or I could get on the seat. You know, I want to feel it in space and think about the composition of it a lot, how it fills up the picture.
Yeah, you do have interesting perspectives on your bike. So what's your favorite medium? What do you paint in for the most part?
For the most part, I use oil.
You do? Wow, you are brave. That's cool. I didn't realize they were oil. I saw a bunch of them this past weekend. Well, you know, your popularity is really high right now. What do you think?
Thank you.
Yeah, what was the biggest factor that kind of elevated you and your work to its current level? What was it that sort of discovered Talia?
Gosh, it's hard to say. I mean, I think having an active website is a big part of it. Just a place that people can look at the work. And then I've been doing a lot of, you know, I promote it as much as I can. And then I've been doing licensing projects. So I did a jigsaw puzzle with a company in Germany, Heya. And I did a calendar with a company in Italy, Legnami. And then I just did a new coffee mug with Fischizzetti here in New York. And I think that having those things out there spreads the word.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Talia Lempert. She is a bicycle painter, but she doesn't paint the objects. She paints canvases of the object. How's that?
Perfect.
That might be okay. So I want to talk a little bit about your custom work. When you're commissioned to do a custom bike painting, do you need the bike in your studio? Do you actually have the bike in front of you?
Yes.
So people send you their bikes?
Yes.
Interesting.
All my work starts by looking at the bike. I don't work from photographs.
So do you determine the angle at from which you approach any specific bike? So you'll set it up a certain way because it's the way you like it or because the client likes it?
Every project is different. When I'm doing a commission, you know, we talk about the project. And a lot of times people say, I love your work and just do your thing. Every day that I work, I photograph the bike and I put it online, or I photograph the picture and then I have it online so they can watch the painting happen, which is really great and takes the pressure off, I think, of doing a commission. But we talk about if they can be as involved as they like. And often if they're local, we'll have a studio visit and look at it, you know, look at the bike and talk about composition and what's important to them about it. And what kind of, if they have a preference with colors and all that kind of stuff. I'll sometimes make sketches. Sometimes I'll make actual painted sketches or drawn sketches. And sometimes I'll make photographs to show different compositional ideas and color ideas.
Nobody has one bike anymore. It's like N plus one is the right number of bikes, right? So do people order more than one painting from you? So let's say, okay, this is my favorite bike this year. I want you to paint my Eisentrout next year. And do people do more than one?
That would be nice. you know, I've had one person, I did two commissions, but it was the same bike. And then I've had people, I mean, a lot of times people buy the paintings, the existing paintings that aren't of their bike, which is pretty special too, actually. And I've had a lot of people be repeat customers of those.
That's cool. What's the lead time?
It really depends. Right now, I'm not going to be taking any commissions until spring. I'm actually working on a new coloring book, and I need some time to focus on that. But usually, I like to have the bike for about 2 weeks is good. I can do it quicker if I need to, and sometimes people leave me the bike for longer.
Wow, that's not a long time. Are you completing the canvas in 2 weeks, or are you doing most of it and then sending the bike on its way and then the painting comes up later?
I'm completing it, and sometimes it takes longer than 2 weeks.
Yeah, sure. What's the most unusual bike you've ever been asked to recreate on canvas? Do you have, you know, like one that's just super weird or super cool? Or
yeah,
super...
I do. Okay. I have a couple. And the weird and wonderful bike is a friend of mine, he had me paint his tall bike, and he did the front wheel is made out of a 4x8 sheet of plywood, so it's like four, you know, in diameter, and then it has all these wonderful holes drilled in it because it was really heavy, and they didn't help at all, but it looks terrific. And it's made out of an old Huffy and some 2x4s and a whole bunch of things and the weightlifting seat.
No way.
Way.
Can you ride it?
I'll send you a picture.
Is it rideable?
Yeah, totally rideable.
No
kidding. Yeah. And that's for sure the weirdest.
That's pretty weird. What's the coolest bike in terms of a high-end bike, say a Merckx or a Lamar? It's something that you never expected to see in your shop.
Well, I've been really lucky to have some pretty fancy racing bikes. One of my favorite ones, I painted Greg LeMond's 1990 tour bike.
Nice.
Which was really amazing looking, and it's so beautiful. The color scheme, so it's 1990s, so it's got a fade, and it's got pink and green and very, you know, dark blue and pearlescent bar tape and crazy Scott drop-in bars.
Those drop-in bars, yeah.
Yeah, it's really fantastic, actually.
It's not a La Vie Claire bike, though, is it?
No, okay. It was a Z, Team Z.
Oh, the Z bike. Oh, yeah, I get it. That's cool.
Yeah.
So I want to just talk one more thing about your work, and then I want to talk about your bicycles, the ones you actually own. One of the favorite items, and you alluded to it a minute ago, that you're working on a new one, are your coloring books. Tell us about your coloring books. What kind of prompted you to take these outlines and turn them into a book? And I think they'd be the most awesome gift for anybody, because adult coloring books, you know, are the big thing right now.
Thank you very much. Well, I've been making coloring books for a while. The one I have now is number 2, and I'm working on number 3. And I like doing different things with the images. The fun part of being an artist is making images. When I'm making a painting, I'm creating an image newly. And then I like to make prints and drawings and stuff based on those images. And so the coloring books kind of came about as a way of doing that. And I also really like the idea of doing something collaborative. I mean, my work is collaborative, even if it's only that I have somebody's bike in my studio or that they don't have their bike. And then the coloring books, I like to think that it encourages people to discover drawing and to celebrate cycling.
That's cool. I like it a lot. Let me remind our listeners one more time. We're speaking with Talia Lempert about her work as a painter and as a cyclist. And now we're going to talk about your collection of bicycles. So you told us about your little white folding Italian bike, the first one you got, and then you got into a track bike. How many bikes do you have right now?
Yeah, I have quite a few. And also, my boyfriend is really into cycling too, and he has quite a few. So we have a pretty good collection going. I've got probably, I would say, at least a dozen.
Do you ride them all?
No, but I ride a lot of them. I've got, of the ones that I ride, I've got like a Rivendell Leroux that's kind of my everyday bike.
Okay.
And I have a rack and baskets on it, and it's pretty terrific. And I have a bamboo bike that I built that's a road bike, and I use that sometimes for road riding and also around town if I'm not going to be carrying a lot of stuff. I have a fancy road bike for going on fancy road rides.
Fancy road rides. What an interesting way of couching it. Fancy road rides. I like that.
Thanks. So I've got a Bob Jackson track bike.
Nice.
That I use on the track. And I have a bike that we just did the Eroica, California. So my old road bike, it's an old steel frame, and I had it just stripped down to the frame. But we redid it for the Eroica, so it's still looking all nice and 80s. And I have some cruisers. I have like a Schwinn Fleet and a Rollfast Space Racer. And all of those at certain times have gotten a lot of use.
Do you guys own a tandem?
Oh, yeah. Well, I also use a cargo bike. I do a lot of craft markets and flea markets and street fairs where I sell prints and T-shirts and coloring books and stuff. And so I have a big cargo bike that's really wonderful that I use for that. And then I've got a Rollfast tandem that's pretty terrific.
Have you made any artistic changes in terms cosmetically to any or all of these bikes?
Not so much.
Okay, you leave them pretty much as is?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I mean, like bar tape or a bell. I don't really do too much remarkable bars, like unique changes. I mean, things happen to them.
Things happen to everything, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's what makes them unique, you know?
Right. Do you have a car?
No. And I learned how to drive pretty late. I learned how to drive when I was 25. And I'm good at it, but I avoid it.
Yeah, I wish I could say the same, you know, but I don't live in Brooklyn, New York, which is bikeable, really, for everything that you need.
Yeah,
or a train. I don't even have that as a possibility, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's one of the good things about living in the city.
Right. What's your favorite food? These are the silly questions.
You know, I like artichokes a lot. and nice. Avocados and asparagus.
They all start with A.
Yeah, and I like berries and all kinds of stuff.
We could go down the alphabet if you want. Okay, well, when you're listening to music, do you listen to music while you work?
I'm usually listening to something, and I go through different phases. Sometimes it's music. I'm not super picky with it. I'll just put on like Pandora or Spotify or something, and just have something going. Or I'll listen to the radio, WNYC,
sure,
NPR, or sometimes I'll listen to audiobooks.
How do our listeners find out more about you and your work?
You can find out more and see my work on my website, and be sure to check out my event page. I usually have something going on.
Okay, so it's bicyclepaintings.com. I am so happy to have been able to sit and talk with you for a while and learn more about you and your work and how you do it. And maybe we'll catch up in Philly next year and actually sit down and for another chat.
I hope so.
Well, thanks so much. Good luck. Enjoy the holiday season, and we'll talk again.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Talia Lempert joined me from her studios in Brooklyn, New York. Delightful young lady, really beautiful work. I saw much of it at the Philly Bike Expo. She wanted me to remind you or to tell you that beginning with November 11th, which would have been yesterday, and through the 24th, every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, she's going to be on Prince Street at the Nolita Market for a sidewalk craft fair, and you can see all of her stuff in Brooklyn, New York. If you have any interest and you're in the area, you can actually meet Talia in person, including her coloring books and her prints and her mugs and all that stuff. So you are listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are going to take a break, and we will be right back.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
The Cleveland Philharmonic Orchestra will continue its 79th season with two December concerts. The first, Saturday, December 10th at 7:30 p.m. at First Church in Painesville, and on Sunday, December 11th at 3 p.m. at Tri-C Western Campus Auditorium. Featuring Shui Wang performing Ravel's G Major Piano Concerto, the concert will include a performance of Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite, Strauss's Blue Danube Waltz, and music for the holiday season. Victor Leva will conduct. Tickets and more information at clevephil.org.
We're back from a break, and I'm going to give you some fresh news. Tour de Tucson's coming up. And TriSports is a sponsor of Junior El Tour. It's a Tucson-based program that provides underprivileged children aged 10 to 12 the opportunity to start cycling. So it's not like they just hand them bikes. The youth participate in a 12-week cycling program that trains new cyclists to ride in the 40-mile El Tour de Tucson cycling event. The program is geared to help children struggling with issues like obesity, low self-esteem, or financial hardship, and instill a sense of teamwork and develop strong work ethic in participating youth. All of the equipment is provided by Junior El Tour. The program offers free training 3 times per week, including sessions with cycling trainers, sports nutritionists, and road safety education. After the children complete the 40-mile El Tour de Tucson ride, happening November 19th, which is coming up next weekend, participants may enroll in a follow-up program for group rides. The program is funded through generous donations from sponsors like TriSports.com. And this year, TriSports delivered 37 bikes to the program with the help of Fuji. Upon successful completion of the 12-week training program, these young riders get to keep their bikes. Last year, 28 kids completed the program and earned their bicycles. 35 youth have registered for the program this year and are slotted to ride in El Tour and earn their bikes. So if you want more information on getting involved with Junior El Tour, if you're in the Arizona area or just like the idea, it is JRELTOUR.org, sponsor information, or you can visit trisports.com. So, you know, we've had Patrick Brady, the author of Red Kite Prayer, on the show quite often for a variety of ideas he has. This week he wrote what I felt was a particularly compelling piece about cycling. It was titled Lessons of the Peloton. And so Patrick offers 12 lessons that he believes have made him a better citizen. Here's the opening of his piece. Of the many recreational pursuits human beings enjoy, I know of nothing that requires the level of skill and fitness required to ride in a Peloton. It is a complicated algorithm of aerobic capacity, sheer strength, endurance, eye-hand coordination, and a level of awareness that's like sporting eyes on the side and in back of your head. The experience required to master pack riding suggests that each participant knows a thing or two about humility, isn't too proud to learn something new. So you can see his 12 lessons. They're really interesting. It's at redkiteprayer.com, and just look for Lessons of the Peloton. So Velo News competitor says that the World Tour will maintain the, quote, status quo, end quote, with 18 teams in the World Tour for now. So UCI's World Tour League remains 18 teams, at least for now. Plans to reduce the top level of the men's peloton to 16 teams have been put on hold till 2020. We'll ask Dan about this. Maybe he'll have some insight into this. In an agreement hashed out during meetings this week in Geneva, the Professional City Council steered around reducing the World Tour's status to just 17 teams next season. Despite the closure of IAM Cycling and Tinkoff, there are new teams coming on next season with Bahrain, Merida, and Peter Sagan's new home at Bora Hansgrohe. Expected to step up. Dimension Data was on the bubble, but will likely stay at the World Tour level thanks to the compromise approved Tuesday. So if you want to know more about World Tour for 2017, you can go to velonews.competitor and check out World Tour maintained status quo. So drones. You don't think too much about drones in cycling. I don't believe we've ever reported anything quite like this in the past. GoPro is recalling the bad karma drones. Now, I don't know if it's bad karma or they're just bad drones named karma drones. Anyway, this was published November 9th from bicycle retailer. GoPro is recalling its karma drones because they can lose power suddenly during operation. The company is giving all GoPro purchasers who return their karma a full refund. Wow, returning karma. Wouldn't that be cool? The company said a small number of the drones have lost power. It said it continues to investigate the issue and is working with the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission and the Federal Aviation Administration on the recall, which involves about 2,500 drones. The company began selling the drones on October 23rd, so they've only been in the air a couple weeks. Some of the drones were sold as a bundle with GoPro cameras and other products, and the company is asking consumers to return the entire bundle for refunds. The company is asking that all of the drones be returned, even if they have not shown any problems. It said it will resume production of the product after the issue is resolved. So for more information, it's gopro.com/2016 karma return. I love it. I think it's awesome. All right. So for I don't know how long now, we've been blaming too much time sitting for just about everything that ails us. So don't sit in front of your computer. Don't sit in front of the TV. Don't sit. So, Grasshopper, it is not necessarily so. Our buddy Dr. Gabe Merkin says that the Mayo Clinic has been doing some due diligence on the matter and has come up with something more compelling. Lack of fitness, not too much sitting, shortens lives. A new study suggests that it is the level of fitness, not time sitting, that predicts susceptibility to disease and longevity. This is from Mayo Clinic Proceedings, published online October 18th, 2016. Heart-lung fitness is the ability of the heart and lungs to provide oxygenated blood to contracting muscles for prolonged periods. In this study, from Norway, the authors followed 495 women and 379 men aged 70 to 77 years old. They measured sitting time with accelerometers and heart-lung fitness by peak oxygen uptake, VO2 peak, and they found that people who spent 12 to 13 hours sitting each day were 75% more likely to have heart attack risk factors, high blood pressure, obesity, diabetes, high cholesterol, high waist circumference, high triglycerides, reduced good HDL cholesterol, high blood pressure, and high fasting blood sugar levels. The most fit people were more than 40% less likely to have abnormal heart attack risk factors, even if they sat for 12 to 13 hours a day and did not meet the criteria for the recommended amount of exercise done each day. People who exercised but were not physically fit were not protected from the heart attack risk factors. Another new study from Rotterdam shows that exercisers live significantly longer than non-exercisers and suffer far fewer heart attacks. For the average Rotterdam citizen, cycling provided the highest level of fitness and was associated with a man living 3.7 years longer than his non-cycling countrymen. And that comes from the Journal of Public Health on October 31st. So sitting will not harm vigorous exercisers. Asking people to stand at work rather than sit is not good advice because standing without moving is no better than sitting and will make you too tired to exercise vigorously when you are finished working. If you are a vigorous exerciser, standing all day will slow your recovery from your exercise program. The highly publicized studies that showed sitting is harmful for exercisers were flawed because they failed to separate casual exercisers from vigorous exercisers. No one has shown that standing up instead of sitting confers any special health benefits, and standing without moving around can cause additional problems such as varicose veins and swollen feet. So very, very cool. Very cool. I like it. I really like it a lot. In fact, I plan to just sit here and not exercise until I get up. How's that? Anyway, my last news item is about locking your bike, or more accurately, how not to lock your bike. Outside Magazine has a pictorial that tells us the best ways how not to lock your bike, beginning with a tree. Most of them are pretty intuitive, but you might see something here you didn't think about in the past. So you can go to Outside Online, 2131296, how not to lock your bike. So that's it for news for this week. We are going to take a break. And we will be back to talk with Dan Worry from Velo News. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
I'm back from a break, and we're going to head on down to Carolina and talk to Dan Worry from Velo News about the 2016 and the 2017 cycling season. Dan, always good to talk with you. Thanks for joining me on the show this week. We've had a lot of stuff go down the pike bike-wise and a lot of other ways since March. So I thought we should dive into the last season. Let's start with the classics because they were happening while we talked, but they hadn't wrapped up yet. Who do you think emerged as a rider we might not have thought about but do now and we will in the future? Who came up and looked really good out of the classics this year?
Well, I tell you, in terms of emerging kind of into prominence, probably doesn't get a whole lot better than Matty Heyman, who rides for Orica Green Edge. You might remember he actually took a win, a big surprise win at Paris-Roubaix this year. He's not an unknown by any stretch. The guy's been a pro for a long time. He's 38 years old. So he's not exactly a sudden revelation. He's had some very strong results in the past, even a couple of top 10 finishes at Paris-Roubaix, but was definitely not the name that was probably on the tip of everyone's tongue in terms of taking the win there.
Okay. How about some of the single rides? So Paris-Roubaix is one, but there were some other rides during the classics, you know, like single events, even if it was a 3 or 4 day ride, some one day that just stood out to you.
Well, I don't know if there was just one day, but definitely a couple of riders that had some very memorable rides that kind of started in the classic season and then they extended for the rest of the year. I think of BMC's Greg Van Avermaet, Certainly Tinkoff's Peter Sagan, who we've talked about in the past. It's funny because, you know, both of these guys are immensely talented riders, but they have been known in the past, in some ways, almost in a joking kind of way, as guys who just had trouble closing the deal sometimes. Between them, they have a shocking number of second place and third place finishes in races. And you might even remember, it was only a little over a year ago at this time that Oleg Tinkoff, the owner of the Tinkoff Bank team, was very down on Peter Sagan and, talking about how he wasn't worth his salary. But boy, both of these guys really came alive during classic season. Ben Avermaet won the Omloop Het No Squad in February, which was a very big deal. He's a Belgian rider, and so this was a home race for him. He went on then and won Tirreno Adriatico, which is a short stage race in Italy. Unfortunately, broke his collarbone at the Tour of Flanders, which kind of put an end to what could have been a pretty amazing classic season for him. But, came back in time for the Tour de France. He took a stage win. He held the yellow jersey for a time there at the Tour and then capped the season, as you might know, winning the gold medal in Rio. So, season for Greg Van Avermaet. Sagan is also certainly no slouch. Just really, came alive after all of that criticism last year from his team owner. Things really turned around for him last October in Richmond. He won the championship here in the States, as you may remember.
I do.
And just really tore it up this year. He won the Tour of Flanders, which was his first really big classics win. He won again Wevelgem this year. He won the points classification at the Tour for the fifth consecutive year. And then managed to successfully defend the rainbow jersey in Doha. So big year for both of those guys.
So let's talk teams a second, because there seems to be a lot of jockeying. A lot of riders are retiring and some new youngsters are coming along. And I think the UCI just announced that it would stick, or the World Tour, with 18 teams again this year. And hopefully maybe they'll look at it in 2020 to cut it back down to 16. What do you see is happening with teams?
You hit on it. That's the UCI has been looking at the prospect of paring down the ranks among the World Tour teams. There are 18 of them currently. The plan had been to sort of bump that down, so there'd be 17 next year, it'd be 16 the year after. I think, for whatever reason, we got to a place here where there were a sufficient number of teams at that level that they just really didn't feel comfortable bumping it down. And that's great news for the Dimension Data team, because they were, I think, sort of on the bubble in terms of being demoted out of the World Tour. That's a real problem for teams, though. A lot of them have contracts with sponsors that suggest that if they don't go to races like the Tour de France, that those sponsorship deals can end. And so, being kind of unceremoniously demoted out of the World Tour ranks can really mean the end of the team, or the death of the team. So, kudos, I think, at least right now, to the UCI for delaying that tactic while they figure out the rest of that deal, because it would be a shame. That Dimension Data is actually the team at this point of Mark Cavendish. So certainly not somebody that we don't want to see at the Tour de France.
Exactly. Let me remind our listeners, we are speaking with Dan Worry. He is the Velo Press at the back dude. I should say Velo News competitor, because Velo Press is the publishing firm. Let's talk a little bit about the 2016 Tour. At one point, people were talking about, well, it's just too long, it's too many stages, yada, yada, yada. It was a pretty good tour this year. Why don't you kind of wrap it up for us a little bit?
Yeah, very good tour this year, and I don't see any. I think there have been discussions in terms of looking at the calendar and paring down certain races. I'm not sure I've heard a lot of discussion about paring down the Tour de France, though, as sort of the crown jewel in the calendar each year. But 2016 again was really kind of all about Team Sky's Chris Froome. This is the third time that he has won the Tour de France. But boy, he really won it in style this year, I have to say. I think he picked up some new fans along the way. He was not always, I think, thought of by a lot of fans as being a real flashy, kind of interesting rider. But, boy, he showed us something new here at this tour. We went into the race thinking, it was likely to be a battle between Froome and Nairo Quintana of Colombia. didn't really much turn out that way. You know, both of them are really amazing climbers, but Froome is certainly a better all-round rider, in particular as, you know, a really strong time trialist, which, you know, I read about this in the Tour de France guide for Velo News. I mean, Quintana is, you know, compared to me and you, Diane, the guy is an amazing time trialist, but compared to Chris Froome at the, you know, the very top of the sport, he's just not quite at that same level. And so with the Tour having as many kilometers this year of time trialing on a couple of different stages, you know, Quintana faced an uphill battle as it was. But Froome just really, I think, surprised some people this year. Two moments in particular that I, you know, point to that just kind of showed his new determination. One was on stage eight, the Col de Parisod, when Chris Froome did this crazy, I don't know if you saw this, crazy downhill attack going down that mountain that just really, I think, broke the race apart. Froome got into this crazy arrow kind of tuck position where he was down on the top tube of his bike and, you know, pedaling downhill. And it just, it just took the whole race by surprise. It's not the kind of thing that has been characteristic of somebody like Chris Froome in the past. And so it, you know, it really, really set him ahead, you know, even early on in the race. The other incident that I think I'll remember for the rest of my life about this Tour de France was on stage 12. You might remember that, you know, as they were going up toward a mountaintop finish, Froome and Richie Porte and Malcolm Olma were involved in a crash when a motorcycle, one of the TB motorbikes, stopped short. You know, the riders kind of crashed into the back of that motorbike, and in the process, Froome broke his bike and ended up taking off on foot, running up the mountain. And his, you know, anyone who has even tried to walk in cycling shoes knows, you know, with those cleats, it's a little bit of a challenge to do much of anything on foot in cycling shoes. But to see Chris Froome all kitted up in the middle of the Tour de France and one of those climbs with all of the fans there at roadside, and to see him running up that mountain was just an amazing sight. It was kind of controversial. Obviously in a cycling race, we don't expect to see a lot of running. And so it is permissible in the rules that you run, but you have to have your bike with you. And so, you know, Froome kind of took off on his own. Frankly, he didn't, you know, I mean, this was not a 2 mile jog he took. Probably only 100 meters or so, but before the team car caught up with him and got him a new bike. But I mean, it was just really a dramatic moment and kind of the photo of the year to see Chris Froome running up the mountain. Fortunately, the race jury looked kindly on that. They recognized that it had been a crash that was out of his control, and they did not penalize him that day, and he was able to keep yellow. But a pretty indelible image.
Well, it's interesting that he would have such presence of mind after smacking into something, breaking his bike, and going, well, wait, but I got to keep going. We're talking about basically Team Sky. You're Chris Froome, Bradley Wiggins. There's some controversy recently. What's going on about the Fancy Bears? What are the Fancy Bears?
Fancy Bears. The Fancy Bears is one of I've always wanted to have somebody ask me about Fancy Bears. Fancy Bears is a Russian computer hacker organization that broke into the World Anti-Doping Agency's data system here over the past several months. And in particular, this was something that was timed sort of around the Olympics. But this Fancy Bears group released online the therapeutic use exemption paperwork for not only people like Froome and Brad Wiggins, but you know, a lot of very prominent Olympic athletes. And
right.
So it was quite a controversy there for a couple of weeks. Therapeutic use exemptions, sometimes we call them TUs, are in essence a prescription to use substances that would be otherwise banned in competition, ostensibly for legitimate medical reasons. And so, you know, it's important to say having a TU is not cheating. These are used in instances where a physician has identified a medical need. Cyclists are people too, and so they, you know, occasionally have medical needs where they need medication. This is something prescribed and recommended by a doctor. It's something that is approved actually by cycling's governing body. But both Froome and Wiggins did get caught up in this release. Froome, not really as much as Wiggins. Froome was disclosed to have had two therapeutic use exemptions for the use of prednisone. It's pretty well known that Froome has struggled at times with asthma. He had actually revealed in interviews and things in the past that he had these therapeutic use exemptions. So really not a whole lot in the way of news in terms of Froome, other than just confirming what he had said previously in the press. The things for Wiggins, though, were much murkier. The hack revealed that he had received three different injections of a very powerful, long-acting corticosteroid that is known as Kenacort in its trade name. If this raises a red flag to you and all that, it should. This was very much the same kind of substance that the U.S. Postal Team is known now to have issued a backdated therapeutic use exemption for Lance Armstrong back in 1999. And this very drug is one that David Miller, who, you know, by his own confession, was a doper during his time in competition. Miller said that this was the single most powerful performance enhancer that he ever took. And so to have these therapeutic use exemptions showing that Wiggins was using that particular drug is a little bit of a red flag, I think, for a lot of people. There are definitely legitimate medical reasons that that someone might need something like Kenacort. What struck people as sort of odd here in the case of Wiggins, first off, he was prescribed this drug for a seasonal pollen allergy. I don't know if you have hay fever at all, and I certainly have struggled in the past, but you know, this is, as best I can determine, I guess a legitimate but a very unusual kind of, you know, heavy-duty way of treating a seasonal pollen allergy. I think the thing, though, that really surprised people the most about these therapeutic use exemptions for Wiggins was the timing of when he got these injections, which was really just before the 2011 and the 2012 Tour de France. So just, that he needed those right in the days before the Tour de France, including one that he won. And then the third one happened just in the days before the 2013 Giro d'Italia. And so to have this powerful, long-acting performance enhancer prescribed by a doctor only in the days before probably the three biggest races of his career is something that has raised sort of a red flag and some eyebrows. You know, did Wiggins cheat? I mean, I think it's only fair to say absolutely not. I mean, this is permitted under the system. This was prescribed by a doctor. It was approved by the UCI. But does it look fishy? Yeah, I mean, I think to a lot of people it really does. And so, at worst, it is a case of making kind of maximum use of the system that is in place. But, you know, at worst, it just looks wrong.
Well, you know, you think about it, and the Giro and the Tour are not so close in time, and then they're in different places. Pollen allergies are usually timed with, say, spring or summer or specific plants and specific allergens. So it does look suspicious to me. Once again, let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Dan Worry. We are wrapping up the 2016 season, and we cannot let it go by without talking about the Olympics. Some riders opted not to go because of the Zika virus. Others didn't perform anywhere near how we sort of expected or believed they would. What's your take on the Olympics for 2016?
Well, you know, the Zika virus question is an interesting one. There was a real threat down in that area from infected mosquitoes. And you know, for young folks who are looking at starting families in particular, Zika poses a particular threat. And so there were athletes who definitely opted out of going to the games. BMC's TJ Van Garderen, probably the most notable example, just said, look, I'm open to start a family soon. This isn't worth the risk for me. And so opted out of even consideration for being named to Team USA. In the end, I'm not sure that it ended up actually preventing too much participation. One thing I have definitely found from talking to athletes of this caliber, you know, when you are someone with the capacity to really go and seriously compete for an Olympic gold medal, I have found there's not much that that gets in your way of going and doing that. We already talked a little bit about Greg Van Avermaet, who won the men's gold medal. But to me, the greatest moments, maybe two of the greatest moments of the year in cycling happened for the women's team and from the Team USA in Rio. The first of those being Kristen Armstrong's return. You know, Armstrong was already a two-time gold medalist in the time trial back in 2008 and 2012. It came out of retirement in 2015, hoping to go back to Rio. She, quickly emerged and won a national championship. But, at age 43, there were some people who really questioned her participation on the squad and her, even her effort to get onto that team. And a lot of people questioned, whether she had earned her spot. She sort of came back out of retirement and initially was, was wanting very much just to focus on time trialing. Questions initially about, she hadn't been active in tons of international competition in comparison to some of her peers over the past couple of years. I also actually had a couple of people tell me basically that they felt like she'd already had her chance and just needed to sort of step aside, which I think that's kind of a silly argument. I think it's a matter of performance, and if you can do it, you can do it, and if you can't, you can't. But it's we don't give out places on Team USA based on whose turn it is. She made it down there. It was a little bit controversial, particularly after she lost the national championship in 2016. She was racing head to head in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, with Carmen Small, and lost. Carmen won that national championship. So there were a lot of people that were a little bit taken aback when Armstrong was selected for Team USA and Small was not. But I'll tell you this about Kristen Armstrong. I've had the chance to spend some time with her during her comeback over the past couple of years. She is a truly fierce competitor. Perhaps the most single-minded person I have met. She definitely wears her emotions on her sleeve in competition a bit. I'm not sure it's always made her the most popular person in the women's peloton, but that selection controversy aside, she showed up in Rio and she won her third consecutive gold medal at age 43. And so I really like Kristen. I like her story. We're both about the same age, so I have to cheer a little bit for the 40-somethings who are still out there making good.
Well, I think standing on the podium with a gold medal sort of mitigates everything else. I'm sorry.
I talked with her a little bit after. I think she certainly made her case pretty convincingly to show up and beat the best in the world. So, the other story of the year from Rio to me was Mara Abbott's ride in the road race. She very nearly won a gold medal on an amazing solo breakaway before she was swept up just like a couple hundred meters before the finish. It was a really heartbreaking loss, but just one of the most memorable and most inspiring things I saw all year. I wrote about this not recently. Mara has written about this. Obviously she feels a lot of pain from that loss. Certainly not my place to tell her she shouldn't feel pain from it, but boy, it inspired the heck out of me. So, very memorable ride from her.
The other person I'd really like to get a little bit of feedback from you on is Evelyn Stevens.
So, Evelyn Stevens was also there at the Olympics. She's had an amazing career, She has actually just retired. Her last race was in Qatar at the World Championships. The Bols Dolmans team won the gold medal in the team time trial, so she went out with a bang. She has a really remarkable story. She came out of the finance sector, was working in New York City, and got kind of recruited into a bike race in Central Park one day. And the next thing we know, she has, left her job on Wall Street and is traveling the world as really one of the best women cyclists this country has ever seen. So, she, I think, has decided that it's time to go back and look at some other things. But, she had an amazing year as well. If nothing else, one that broke the women's hour record here this year. And so, leaves the sport as the current hour record holder. So, I think as far as Evie goes, just I think what I'll remember about her most is just her spirit and her positivity. I mean, she's an incredibly talented writer, but just as a person is amazing, Diana. I mean, she loved the sport and just really put her all into it.
The last thing we should talk about is maybe some, not predictions, but some things you see unfolding for the new cycling season in 2017.
2017. Well, I guess I'll start by going way, way out on a limb and tell you, you want to watch these guys, Chris Froome and Peter Sagan. You know, those guys had such an amazing 2016. I don't see any way or any reason that, you know, barring some significant injury to one of them, that they are slowing down. And I think we're going to see a lot of really big things from both of them. You know, the other couple people that I might mention as folks to watch, we've talked about Taylor Finney many times in the past. You know, there was some scuttlebutt going around that maybe Taylor was going to hang things up this year as well. And that's not what happened. He actually has chosen to leave BMC, where he has been for a long time, and has signed with Jonathan Waters and the Cannondale-Drapac team. And so he's, you know, going to a new place. He's had a lot of ups and downs over the past couple of years. As you know, he had a really significant leg break a couple of years back at the national championships and has worked his way back from that. But I think we've not yet seen the end of Taylor Finney. So be looking for a very tall, lanky guy in green Argyle next year is one of my predictions. You know, the other thing, the other person that I would say, Diane, you've definitely got to watch, who we really haven't had a chance to talk about yet, is Megan Garnier. Megan is a teammate of Evelyn Stevens at Coles Dolman's team. She's a native of New York and has spent a lot of time in the recent years in Europe racing, and so maybe is a little bit less, you know, front and center on the radar for a lot of American cycling fans, but is hands down, you know, not only the best American women's cyclist, but maybe this year's very best cyclist, period.
Wow.
Megan won the very first UCI Women's World Tour this year. She won the Giro Rosa. She won the Tour of California. She won the Philly Cycling Classic. She won her third U.S. National Road Race Championship in Winston-Salem. So, you know, hard to say anything other than that Megan Garnier is the top female cyclist in the world right now. And, you know, I don't think she gets nearly enough credit for that.
Well, as always, it is just unbelievably wonderful to be able to talk to you and hear all this stuff that if you aren't on it and in it every single day like you are at Velo News, you know, you don't get to kind of wrap it into a neat package like you did for us today. And I really appreciate it.
Anytime.
All right. Well, you have a wonderful holiday season, Thanksgiving and the other big holidays, gift-giving holidays, as we like to say, are coming up. We will catch up again in 2017.
Thanks, Diane. I appreciate you having me.
And you have a great day. Thanks, Dan.
All right.
Bye-bye. Dan Worry joined me from his home in Carolina. I always enjoy talking with Dan because he has so much information right at the tip of his fingers. I don't think he writes any of this stuff down. It just comes right out. You can tell just from the conversation that he knows all this stuff about riders and teams and races and stages. It's really, really cool. So that's our show for this week. I'd also like to thank Talia Lempert for being on the show. Again, if you have any interest in having your bicycle turn out to be a custom painting, you can go to bicyclepaintings.com. So we'll be back with a new show next week. Thank you so much for listening. I hope it's nice in your neighborhood so you can go out and take a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next week at this same time with more conversation and news from the world of cycling. If you missed any part of today's show, download the podcast from iTunes or WJCU.org. And you can follow The Outspoken Cyclist on Facebook and Twitter to keep the conversation going throughout the week. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.